All right, please help me welcome our speaker tonight. Our speaker is Chris S. From the Spiritual Awakenings Group in Bernardsville, New Jersey.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Chris, and I am an alcoholic. I'm really, really glad to be speaking here tonight. I spoke here about 2 years ago, and I could just tell that there was an enthusiasm in this meeting. There was something going on in this meeting that was just really cool. So when I was asked to come here again, you know, I know some home group members and I know this meeting, I was really glad to be asked. You're doing some really good things out here in Quakertown. Anyway, I am an alcoholic. I'm one of those pathetic kind of alcoholics, the kind of person who, you know, who's drinking over at your house and passes out in your Chase lounge and, you know, backs over your shrubberies, you know, trying to leave, and, you know, you find, you know, just I vomit on your carpet and do really inappropriate things to, like, family members, and, you know, and you just tell me never ever to ever come back again, you know, don't ever be drinking in my presence again. You know, I'm one of those guys. I've had a lot of trouble driving drunk. You know, I come from a period of time where friends did let friends drive drunk. And, you know, I had a lot of car accidents and, you know, loss of license. And, you know, it was mostly vindictive police officers that, were really singling me out, you know, for persecution and all that. I had a lot of problems with that. You know, it's really funny. I'm here tonight with some of my, I'm going to tell the story of my first DUI. Okay. It wasn't really too far from here. It was just over the border, into New Jersey in a town called Pittstown. And they had this country bar back in the 70s where they'd have country music, and you just have a really good time at this place. And you know, I went there with my friend Andrea. You know, she was 15 at the time with one of those fake licenses. Remember the paper driver's licenses that you could alter, you know? And she's 15, and she's drinking at the bar with me. I'm 19, and I remember chugging pitchers of beer. Now, that's not how social drinkers have beer. They very rarely chug pitchers. Okay, that's an important warning sign if you're wondering if you're alcoholic. You know, I remember very little of this night, except that I did allow myself to become overserved, and on the way home, I hit some black ice or something, and the car spun around and hit a bridge abutment going backwards. Now Andrea was smart enough not to drive home with me, to find somebody else who's smart enough to say, you know, I'm going to get a ride with somebody else. So I'm alone, thank God. But anyway, the car spins around, hits a bridge abutment, and I get thrown out the back window. I remember, like, coming to and looking up, and I'm seeing the stars, and my legs are still in the car. But it's a Toyota, and it's still running. So what do you do when something like this happens? You go home, right? You drive. What are you going to do? Just stand there like an idiot? So I get back in the car. Now picture this: there's not a window left in this car. It's bent like a boomerang. The drive shaft is slapping the frame. It's got three flat tires, and I'm going home. Now, about a mile down the road, I pass a cop giving radar. He's taking radar, and you know he's like, he doesn't even pull me over. He like walks me over. Because I'm going about 1 mile an hour. You know, whacking a boogie bam, whacking a boogie bam. And he reaches through the window and he starts shaking me. He's like, where did you have that accident? I'm like, what accident, officer? You know, glass flying out of my hair. He goes, where are you going? I go, Basking Ridge. He goes, that's 28 miles. You don't have any tires. I'm like, you cops are always hassling me. So that was DUI number one. Now the funny thing is I lose track of Andrea pretty soon after that. You know, I'm wondering why. I'm thinking, you know, there's probably a pretty good reason. But anyway, I lose track of her after that. About 6 months after that, we bump into each other again about a year ago, and she's now my fiancée. This is somebody from 33 years ago back in my past, and that's just really a cool thing. But she drives when we do most of this stuff. Anyway, you know, I am an alcoholic. The defining characteristic of alcoholism is an obsession of the mind coupled with a phenomenon of craving. And to identify, I'm just going to explain how those two things present within me. The phenomenon of craving is pretty easy. Every single time I took a drink of alcohol, this is from the first time I drank, every single time I took a drink of alcohol or take a drink of alcohol, one thing happens, and it happens every single time. And that is, I want another drink. And the second drink wants the third drink. And the third drink insists on the fourth drink. And the fourth drink demands the fifth drink. And I get tongue-chewing, knee-walking, not able to operate my own pants zipper drunk. You ever been that drunk? That would happen to me every single time, and I would pass out. Okay, I just, 9 times out of 10 when I drank, I passed out, just fell to the floor. And I usually had a full drink in my hand. Okay, so I would be so blithering, blackout drunk, just that I'm gonna be able to stay conscious about 4 more seconds, and I'm pouring myself a big giant cocktail. That's the phenomenon of craving that happens with alcoholics. That's why when we go out to have a couple, we close the bar. You know, well, what happened? Well, I don't know. You know, I close the bar again. And that's the phenomenon of craving. Now, that's pretty easy to understand. The part that's tough, as far as identifying and fully conceding to my innermost self that I'm alcoholic, is the obsession of the mind. Because my ego wants to take ownership and control over my drinking and my sobriety. My ego wants to think that it's making the decisions. But what happens is, by my admitting to powerlessness over alcohol, what I'm really admitting to is I'm not the one who's in charge of whether I drink again, when I drink again, if I'm going to drink again, what's going to happen. I don't have power, choice, and control over putting alcohol back in my body in an unrecovered state. And that part is really difficult for me to grasp. In the book Alcoholics Anonymous, it says we fully concede to our innermost selves that we're alcoholic. And then it gives about 12 examples of the obsession of the mind. Suddenly the thought crosses my mind that I can put some vodka in the milk and it won't hurt me on a full stomach. And you know, then I'm pounding the bar wondering, how did I get drunk again? It talks in there about the strange mental blank spot that precedes the first drink. It talks about not being conscious, not being aware, not having the access to sound reasoning and judgment where alcohol is concerned. And I'll use a story from my own experience to show how this manifested in my life one day. Alcohol was destroying my life many, many years before I became serious about quitting it. And then when I became serious about quitting it, I found that I couldn't. I mean, I would make a decision every single morning. I would come to, and I'd be just hungover as hell. I'd be in the clothes that I passed out on the floor in the night before. And the first thing I'd do is get up and I'd go into the bathroom and do my vomiting calisthenics, you know, and then like brush my teeth, throw some water on my face, you know, get ready for work, because I worked, you know. I'd be driving to work, and if I would get pulled over driving to work, and they breathalyzed me, I would have failed the breathalyzer. And I hadn't had a drink since 7 o'clock the night before. It's 12 hours later. But I drank so much hard liquor, it would just come out of my pores the next day. I like stunk of either bourbon or vodka, just because I drank so much the night before. Now, on the way to work, I would be swearing to God, this is the day. This is the day I'm quitting. I don't ever want to feel like this again. I'm quitting. I'm not going to drink tonight. I'm not going to do this again. I'm through with this booze. It makes me too ill. I'm like shattered. I want to kill myself. I mean, you know, the alcoholic can take hangovers that, like, normal earth people would go to the emergency room if they felt half that bad. You know what I mean? Like, oh, you know, and we, like, we go to work. It's like, you know, our head is split in half. So I would be swearing to God I'm never going to drink again. And let's say you had a lie detector. And you put the lie detector on me, and the polygraph expert asks me the question, Chris, are you ever going to drink again? No. The polygraph guy said, he's telling the truth. You can put money on it, he is never drinking again. Because I meant it. At 8 in the morning, at 9 in the morning, at 10 in the morning, I meant it. I never, ever wanted to drink alcohol again, ever. But what would happen was... somewhere around noon, I'd rehydrate. I'd drink about a gallon of something, and I'd have half a sandwich, and I'd start to feel a little bit human again. And quitting time would be coming my way, and I'd start to think, you know, that decision you made, you know, this morning about never drinking again, that's a serious decision. You know? I think that's actually an overreaction to a problem I think I could handle, and you know, I might have to modify that decision, and, you know, to never drink again. As a matter of fact, I should probably stop at the liquor store on the way home from work, and I would stop at the liquor store. So this is a cycle, and the ego wants you to think you're changing your mind, but that's not what it is. It's the insanity that the second step talks about. Not having access to sound reasoning and judgment where it concerns alcohol. And knowing it's the, you know, most alcoholics know putting alcohol in your body is a bad move. How many times have you come to with like a summons in your back pocket? Or, you know, you're not in the big bed anymore for a while, you know. Or you've lost another job. I mean, how many times has that happened to us? Yet we continue to keep drinking. What is that? That's the obsession of the mind. Now, here's how I came to this realization. This is how I fully conceded to my innermost self that I was alcoholic. I signed myself into a 28-day treatment program in early 1989. And I was the only person in this treatment center that just walked in and said, help me. Everybody else was there for DUIs and, you know, work interventions and all this. I really was the only guy. I really signed myself in, you know, paid the $12,000 and said, help me, I'm dying. I went to the 28-day program. They released me. I was going to AA meetings, two AA meetings a week, and two outpatient a week. And I was telling everybody, I'm done with booze. I'm doing what these guys are telling me to do, and I'm done with booze. I'm not drinking anymore. And I made it almost 90 days. I was on my way to an AA meeting, and the thought crossed my mind that I hadn't been drunk in months. As a matter of fact, I don't even really remember what it's like to be drunk. I'll bet if I bought a gallon of vodka and took it back to my house and started drinking it, it would remind me why I'm doing all this recovery stuff. And I'll have like a renewed enthusiasm for this sobriety because it will make me feel so bad. So I drank a gallon of vodka to improve my sobriety. You know, here's the thing. Alcohol doesn't care what it needs to tell you to get alcohol back in your body. It'll tell you anything. And I wanted away from alcohol so bad that my mental capacity talked me into drinking it because it would help my recovery. You know, so when I came off of that run, which was like 7 months, you know what I mean? Because it was just, it was horrible. Here's what happened. I've got the gallon of vodka and I'm mixing it up with orange juice. Good idea. It's a good idea. Have one drink. Another drink. Good idea. Good idea. I'm halfway through the third drink and all of a sudden I go, oh my God, what have I done? I'm drinking again. I opened up the cage door to the beast and he's going to move me around like a puppet, you know, for months. Who knows? How could I have been so stupid? And there's examples in the big book about that. You know, the car salesman, there's Jim, there's the jaywalker, there's the man of 30. They give example after example after example of people who can't not drink and go to meetings. Who can't put the plug in the jug. Who can't just not drink one day at a time. But there's example after example after example of people who do not have access to that type of power, choice, and control. And I'm one of them. So, you know, that places me in a position where I am totally hosed. It's not a good place to be. So for 7 months, I'm drinking, you know, and I've been to AA, I've been to treatment, I was in outpatient, I've had counselors. This is really a bleak place to be. It's no more fun. It's no more fun drinking when you've had all that information. So the last drunk was a Butte. It was Christmas 1989 at my mother's house. Brothers, sister, nieces, nephews, animals, family animals. You know, the Christmas tree was all decked out with presents under it. The Christmas carols were on the stereo. Stockings were hung by the chimney with care. And I started to drink Johnny Walker Black. Okay? That was my Christmas drink. Did anybody in here ever have a Christmas drink? Something special that you drank at Christmas? Well, all right. Well, mine was Johnny Walker Black. And I started drinking it, and I got a resentment about something. You know how we are. Somebody was doing something that I didn't like, you know? And so I pull out a .38 caliber handgun and threaten them all. All right? I'm going to kill all you! This wasn't the festive mood everybody was looking for. You know what I mean? So I'll tell you, AA is the only place where people would laugh about that. You know? If I told that story at the Rotary Club or something, you know what I mean? Oh. But we know. Anyway, you know, they pick up their Christmas and they move it elsewhere, thank you. Now, I come out of like a multi-day blackout. This was absolutely awful. I mean, I had never been in a blackout for 4 or 5 days before. But I come out of this and, you know, I come off the floor and I stagger into the kitchen to try to hydrate up. You know how thirsty you are. And I'm shattered. And I walk in and I see a pile of vodka bottles in the sink that I don't even remember buying. And I used to buy them one bottle at a time. So I must have been staggering around town in a blackout for days. But I started to go into the DTs. Anybody in here ever experienced the delirium tremens? You know, they're 15% of alcoholics get to the point where they suffer delirium tremens. They go down the scale that far. And out of the 15% that suffer from them, something like 15 to 30% of them die from the delirium tremens. Because what happens is your pulse rate goes up to 12 billion over 5,000 and you pop your aorta like a faulty garden hose. And that's usually what happens. You stroke out, whatever. Anyway, I start hallucinating and you know, I'm flopping around and there's maggots on me and there's animals running around and I'm hearing marching bands. You know what I mean? Like marching bands. Where's that come from? Whenever I'm in a beginner's meeting and there's like new people around and there's music coming from somewhere, I lean over and I say, I can hear that too. You know? Anyway, one of my favorite things to do is every once in a while you get the crack people in the AA meetings, you know, the people who are coming off of crack. And here's what you do. You sit next to one of them and, you know, they're sitting there like they got the shakes and stuff. And you lean over to me and you go, are those people looking through the window at me or you? You get their attention. And that's what we want. We want your attention. Anyway, you know, I'm in a horrible state. I'm seeing demons. I mean, it was really, really ugly. I finally get to the point where I'm, you know, I'm starting to come out of this detox. And I know where I need to go. I know I need to go back to Alcoholics Anonymous because that's really the only place that's gonna have an answer. I just know that intuitively. The prayer that I said when I started seeing the demons was, God, please either kill me or let me get sober. I can't live like this anymore. Now, this is a very, very common prayer. I've met 100 people who've said this prayer just prior to getting sober. And since I said that prayer, I haven't had a drink. And that was December 28th, 1989, or so. I wasn't really close to the calendar at that point in time. So what happened was I realized I needed to go to a meeting. Now, I don't know about anybody else, but I was busy when I drank. I mean, I drank, okay? I didn't have time for a lot of other stuff. I had a car. I didn't have time to, like, fix it. So I had this car. It had no muffler. It had no clutch. It had no emergency brake. It had no heater core. This is the middle of winter, so if you turned the heater on, it would squirt antifreeze on the inside of the window. You know what I mean? It had busted up quarter panels. So this thing was just horrible. And it was a real Quaalude car. And I used to buy $100 cars because I used to wreck them a lot, you know? And every once in a while, it would smash into you, and you'd have like a late model BMW. And I'd go, what? I'd jump out of my car. I'd go, what the hell's the matter with you? This is probably like a $30,000 car. Are you crazy? Buying something like this? I buy a $100 car. You have an accident like this, it's no big deal. I just call the junk man. I got all this insurance problems with you now and everything. And a lot of times they didn't really see eye to eye with my philosophy. Unreasonable drivers. Anyway, because there's no clutch in my car, I'm looking through the meeting book. I have to find a flat meeting. Okay? So I'm looking through the meeting book for a flat meeting. And I find one in Morristown, New Jersey. It's all highway, okay? So I can get there. It's flat. And, I'm still like completely out of my mind, shattered. And, I'm driving along. And I get to this meeting, and there's a little hill where you have to go up this little hill into the parking lot. Now, I've got no clutch and no mufflers, so I really have to gun the thing to get up that little hill. And it's right there where the porch is, where everybody's having cigarettes. There's like 150 people having cigarettes out on the porch. And I'm driving up this hill, and I got to gun it. So the car's going, whoa! Like this, about 1 mile an hour. And you can see everybody like looking, you know. Must be a new guy, you know. And I was. I pulled in and I parked the car against a tree in the lot. I had to, because the parking lot wasn't flat. And the emergency brake was gone, the clutch was gone, and it rolled. So I parked it up against the tree. And, you know, I noticed nobody parked close to me that day either. You know, the lot was full except right around my car. And I went into the meeting. Now, you know, you got to understand how shattered I was. I was like, you know, I was like this. And, you know, I go in and I had misread the book. I thought it was a beginner's meeting. It ended up being a step meeting. And I sit down and the place is almost full. And somebody, you know, I'm sitting there and somebody's talking, somebody's doing something, somebody's reading something, you know, and and all of a sudden somebody taps me and goes, "Here, here's a step bump. We're reading out of step 12. I go, I take the book and I look down the row, and they're coming down the row at me. They're reading a paragraph each and they're coming down the row at me. And I freak out. Okay, I'm like, "Oh my God." So I get up and I leave. You know, I mean, I didn't know how to hold the book right side up. I was out of my mind. So, you want me to read? So I'm outside, I'm having a cigarette, and I'm thinking, you know, this stuff is too hard. I don't think I'm going to be able to do this. I'm going to be able to do this. And this guy, Jorge, saw me get up and leave and comes out of the meeting. And, you know, walks up to me and he goes, "Hey, my name's Jorge. How you doing?" I'm like, "Oh, this is horrible. All these relapses. I'm just coming back. It was demons and maggots all over. I'm vomiting. Horrible, horrible." And he goes, "Well, come on inside. Come on back in the meeting." And I'm like, "Oh, there's a meeting tomorrow. The meeting tomorrow I'm going to go to, you know, nearer my house." And he knew enough to know what tomorrow meant. Okay, so he wouldn't take no for an answer. He kept going, "Come on, come on, come on." He's like making a scene now. So I go, all right. He drags me back into the meeting. And the only places left are, there's a couple of seats up in the second row. And we sit down and you know, they're done reading now. And somebody's sharing now. You know, somebody's sharing on step 12. And then, you know, I'm sitting there like this. And he taps me on the shoulder and he goes, "Okay, now raise your hand and tell everybody you're coming back." And I'm like, "Well, tell everybody I'm coming back." I go, "There's a meeting tomorrow." And everybody raises their hand because everybody's coming back. And he's like, "No, raise your hand." And he's starting to get loud, okay? And people are starting to look at me now. They're starting to look over and see what's going on. And you know what happens when they start looking at you? They'll be thinking at you soon. You know what I mean? When you're detoxing, you can hear people thinking at you. And it ain't pretty. So I'm starting to panic now. So I've never seen this done before. I've never seen it done after. Okay? Right in the middle of this woman sharing on step 12, I raise my hand. Right in the middle of her sharing. And the leader of the meeting is like, you know, wondering. So the leader of the meeting shuts the person up who's sharing and calls on me. And, you know, I shared something like this: "Crystal alcohol, horrible relapse, kill myself, some demons, some animals, and marching bands, so thank you." And it's dead quiet. Okay? And then all of a sudden, it starts. Everybody starts going, "Yeah!" And they're like cheering, okay? And I took it as acceptance at the time. I now know what it is. It's like, "You pathetic bastard! Oh my God! Oh, you're so trashed! Oh, I came in here with my own problems, and oh, you've made me feel so good about my life. Thank you. At least I'm not you." And that's what it really was. But I took it as acceptance. And, you know, here's what happened to me that night. I had a wall of self-centered fear. Self-centered fear presents in the alcoholic like anxiety. Like an inability to deal. Like, "I don't want to go there. I don't want to do that with those people then." You know, that's what happens to us with the self-centered fear. The self-centered fear keeps us from being able to step out easy. We don't step out easy. For years, I wouldn't go near a store with fluorescent lights. You know what I mean? Well, I wouldn't stand in line. I wouldn't fill out forms. I just wouldn't do any of that, you know? If you needed that done, that's your problem. Because I couldn't deal. I had that anxiety. That, you know, it's after the dash. Our lives had become unmanageable. It's one way the alcoholic unmanageability presents in our life. Is an inability to deal. We have lack of dealage. Okay. Now, Now, I start going to AA with a willingness born of desperation. I almost died in that last detox, and I really didn't want to die, and I almost killed my family, which would have been very inconvenient. You know what I mean? I had some affection for them, and that would have, you know, that probably would have ruined the rest of my week if I would have killed them. So this got my attention, you know? And so I started going to Alcoholics Anonymous like crazy. My second day in, I got a sponsor, Fish Food Phil. You know, everybody had nicknames back then, and I figured it out later. It was because I was nicknaming them. But my first buddy, Radio Shack Mike, you know. Anyway, I went up to Phil and I said, Phil, I've been in hell. I want to get out. Will you help me? He had brought meetings into the treatment center I was in, and he would bring meetings into the outpatient that I was in, and I saw him at the AA meetings. So he was a perfect person for me to ask, and he was a great first sponsor. What Phil did for me was this. He said, Chris, I want to see you at a meeting every single night until I tell you to stop. That was his instruction. So what he covered, there's three legacies. There's the circle and triangle, unity, recovery, and service. And to have a balanced Alcoholics Anonymous protection program, you really need to be operating in all three sides of the triangle. So many of us relapse because we're treating a threefold illness with a one-fold solution. We're going to meetings. We're two-fold short. And the thing that Phil did for me was he got me involved in meetings. He got me involved in meeting consistency right off the bat. It was none of this go whenever you want. It was he wanted to see me at a meeting every single night. I did that for 8 years. I'm not saying I needed to. I just became disciplined at it. My feet took me to meetings. There was no debate. I didn't allow myself, you know, the luxury of having other things to do. I just booked in those meetings, and that's where I went. He also got me involved in service, which is another part of the triangle, another legacy. What he had me do is he had me start to do things for fun and for free, not expecting anything back. And it was the first time in my life I ever was to do that. I really thought I was like a generous person when I came into AA. I thought I was magnanimous, like I was a really good guy, that I would do things for people. Well, I never did anything for anybody without expecting something back in return. No matter what it looked like, there was agendas. There was hidden agendas. So what he started to have me do is drive people from, you know, the treatment center to the AA meetings, to start carrying the message into treatment centers. He had me volunteering as a coffee maker over here, as a cook for the sober barbecue over there. He got me involved in service, and I started to get very, very busy. Now, what this did was it enabled me to stay sober long enough to find a recovery program in the fellowship and in service. What do I mean by that? Going to meetings and doing service is not a treatment for alcoholism. Okay? At best, what it will do is it will create an atmosphere of sobriety. However tentative, it'll create an atmosphere of sobriety. Some people stay in that sober space for long, long periods of time. And sobriety is probably preferable to drinking. But this is basically what happened with me. I was sober about a year, and I was going to meetings like crazy. I was making coffee till the grinds were coming out of my ears, and I was doing service commitments all over the place. If you said, Chris, would you do that? I'd say yes. You know, I'd be out at the diner after every single meeting with the newer people trying to help out. I was saying yes to everything Alcoholics Anonymous was asking me, and I was dying an alcoholic death right in the middle of the rooms. What was happening was with me was that self-centered fear was all over me. I was depressed. I was anxious. I had guilt and shame and remorse that were all over me. I mean, I had done some things that I saw as just horrific. You know, my particular moral compass wouldn't allow me to be able to deal with some of the things that I did when I was drinking and when I was doing drugs. I had resentments that were unbelievable. I would see slights and I would see attacks that didn't exist. Nobody was attacking me, but I would see it as an attack. And I would wake up in the morning and my resentment machine would turn on. This is in recovery. This is in sobriety. You know, 12 months into the AA meetings. My head had come off the pillow in the morning and the first thing I'd think of is, those bastards! You know what I mean? Does anybody relate to that? Where, you know, you're just figuring out how to get even with them? You know, because they did something to you? So I had the resentments and, you know, I had shame all over me and fear. But I'm going to meetings. I'm doing my job in AA. But I don't realize that I'm not recovering. I'm not working a program. I'm working a fellowship, which is a completely different thing. Radio Shack Mike one day hands me a set of 90-minute tapes. And these, you know, I'm like, oh, what is this? And, you know, 8 90-minute tapes. Like, well, what is this? And he goes, it's a big book thing for a couple of guys from Arkansas did it. You know, I'm like, Arkansas? 12 hours worth of, you know, guys talking from Arkansas? You know, and I'm thinking, oh man, but I take him, and he goes, no, you're hardcore, you'll probably like it. I didn't really like him, but you'll probably like it. So I've got a long ride to work, okay, so I decide, I'll throw it in. And what happened was, these two guys from Arkansas started talking about a program of recovery. This is something I had never heard in North Jersey AA meetings. I heard group therapy. I heard keep it simple, stupid. You know, I heard share your problems and update everybody on your drama du jour. You know what I mean? And here's my opinion about that particular step that I've never done. And this is what I'd heard. A lot of that. All of a sudden, I start to hear these two guys talking about true recovery experience. And it upsets me, okay? I'm like, this isn't how we do it in Jersey. I don't know, whatever these guys in Arkansas got, they can keep it, you know? This isn't how we share in New Jersey, you know? And I made it through the tape set just to be able to tell Radio Shack Mike I had listened to it. Okay? It was important for him to hear that. So I listened through it, but I had an attitude. What happened was, some things happened in my life. In the book Alcoholics Anonymous, it says, if your spiritual life is not in good shape, the trials and the low spots ahead, you're not going to be able to get past them without getting drunk. Okay? That happens to a lot of us. We get put in the barrel. Two or three things happen. A divorce, a loss of a job, a mortgage foreclosure, death in the family. You know, a bunch of these things happen to us all at once, and we just don't get to the other side of them because our spiritual condition isn't strong. And what happened to me was about two or three really bad things happened. And I was at a point where really, I was really confronted with a couple of different ways to go. One of them was to kill myself. I really thought about it. To end this tragic, horrible, uncomfortable charade called life. There's a statistic out there that alcoholics are 60 times more likely to take their own life than a non-alcoholic. And we do it because we get to a place of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And it usually happens when we're sober. We rarely kill ourselves when we're drunk. We usually kill ourselves when we're sober. And I was at a place where I'm going to all this AA and I'm just feeling really, really bad. So one road would have been to kill myself. The other road would have been to drink. Because I knew drinking was a bad option. I knew that. However, somewhere between drink 4 and drink 8, there was a little bit of peace. You know what I mean? you'd get to that place where you could just go, you know, and let everything drop off of you. And then you became a vomiting pig. But there would be that brief little window where, you know, you would feel okay. The other option was I started to remember these tapes. There's another line in the Big Book that says, if you've disturbed somebody about their alcoholism, this is all to the good. If you've hit somebody between the eyes with some truth and it's pissed them off, this is all to the good. And that's what Joe and Charlie did to me. They challenged me on what I was doing to stay sober. I was the fellowship pope, but I was doing nothing that was going to transform my spirit. Nothing that was going to change me from a selfish, self-centered, self-seeking individual. Because that's really what alcoholism is. Alcoholism is an illness of self-centeredness. And I wasn't doing anything to change that. I was just going to a lot of meetings. And, you know, people were patting me on the head. Chris, you're doing a great job. Pat, pat, pat. You know, see you at all the meetings. Making all the coffee. You're doing great. And you can't really tell them the truth. You can't say to them, well, I don't feel great. I actually feel like killing myself and you, too. You know? Because you identify yourselves as a grateful alcoholic, and every single time you do that, I think about slashing your tires in the parking lot just to test that theory out and see whether you're telling the truth or not. You know? How are you doing? You know? You can't be honest like that, so you just smile and say, yeah, I'm doing great. You know? Doing great, you muttonhead. So I'm confronted with my spiritual condition, which is in the toilet. And what I do is I take out these tapes and I put a little tape player and I get a big book, something I had never opened since rehab. Okay, everything was 12 and 12. I was going like four 12 and 12 meetings a week. And 12 and 12 meetings are great, you know, unless you want to be around people that are actually doing steps. So anyway, I open up the big book, I put the tapes on, I got a notebook with a pen, and I start to go through the book. And where there's an actual instruction, turn the tape off, do the instruction. When I'm finished with the instruction, turn the tape back on and move forward. Operating like someone announced earlier, you know, before the meeting started, operating like it's a textbook. That's what Joe and Charlie told me to do, like the book is a textbook. Could you imagine, and this is what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous, unfortunately. Could you imagine, let's say you wanted the calculus experience. You wanted to really understand and benefit from calculus. So you started to go to the college and you started to sit in the calculus classroom. And you'd sit there and you'd listen to people talk about calculus and share about calculus and you'd share about calculus and you'd be grateful, you know, for calculus. But you never open up the calculus textbook. You never solve any of the problems so that you can't apply any of this stuff to your life. You just sit in the calculus classroom. Wouldn't that be crazy? That's what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous every day. What I was like for the first year and a half was I was like the person who would go to the terminal and watch the planes take off and talk about flying. You know, flying is really great, and you know, there's a 727, and that's a beaut, you know. But I never get on the plane. This is the message that Joe and Charlie were sharing with me, and it upset me because, you know, my ego did not want to be confronted with the fact that I wasn't doing my job in Alcoholics Anonymous because I was doing everything. So I came to terms with that. I started to move through the book, and some things started to happen in my life. The resentment started to go away. The self-centered fear, the anxiety, the inability to step out and go do the things that I knew I needed to do that were good for me and for other people. You know, the things that I was just uncomfortable about, that uncomfortability started to leave. the guilt and the remorse about the things I did in the past, they melted away as I started moving through my amends. And I started to have what the steps call a spiritual awakening as the result of the 12 steps. Now, you know, this was all kind of new to me, and I please understand I was not doing this out of any sense of virtue. I just didn't want to feel bad anymore, and I'd run out of plans, and this was a plan that was suggested, and I just started to do it. I didn't understand what was going to be at the other side. I didn't know what recovery was because I hadn't experienced it. I didn't know what a spiritual awakening was because I hadn't experienced it. It was all just an opinion until I actually had experienced it. Now, I go through the steps as best I could, you know, with really no guide except a set of tapes. And by this time, I was sponsoring some people. I learned early on in AA how to give good share. You know, how to share just the right way with just enough, you know, self-deprecating, you know, like, you know, talk about how stupid I was today and how funny it was, and, you know, I learned just how to share so people would like me, because it was very important for people to like me. I was very attached to that. If there was 50 people that liked me and one person that didn't, who do you think I would focus on? You know, it would be the one person who didn't care for what I had to say. So I had to be very careful about how I shared. So you do that, and sometimes you get sponsees. But the thing was, these sponsees were drinking on me. Anybody ever have sponsees drink on you? Make you look bad? You know what I mean? Is Harry yours? You know, he's hitting on the new women. He's borrowing money. And Harry's mine. I'll talk to him. Yeah. Well, you know, I had a whole ton of these guys, okay? There was a period of time where every sociopath in AA was asking me to sponsor. It was horrible. But anyway, I come up with this idea. I've just gone through the big book the way Joe and Charlie have told me to go through in these tapes. I know, I'll get these drinking AAs over to my house and we'll start going through the big book the way I was shown. And that's what I did. I mean, these guys came over and I started, you know, the title page. We have Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I'd just start reading. And where there was an instruction, we'd stop and we would both do it. I really thought that if I was carrying the message to these guys, I would have to do it too. I couldn't just ask them to do something that I wasn't willing to do myself. You know, so literally going through, taking these guys through the book, which I probably took 30 or 40 people in the 90s through, maybe more, I went through the steps again too. And here's what I learned. And this is significant because alcoholism is a progressively fatal illness. Over any considerable period of time, it always gets worse. It never gets better, whether you're drinking or not. Okay? It doesn't say if you continue drinking. It says over any considerable period of time, alcoholism gets worse. It doesn't get better. If anybody tells you, you know, keep coming, it gets better, they're lying to you. Your alcoholism isn't going to get better. You can treat it, but your liver and your pancreas are going to continue to get worse. And if you ever put alcohol back in your body, it's going to be way worse than the last time you were drinking. How many people in here have relapsed and realized that it's worse now than it ever was before? That's because our liver and our pancreas deteriorate and we can't metabolize alcohol. So what happens with recovery is the guys that went through the book with me, there were people who balked on the fourth and the fifth step, there were people who balked on amends. You know, you're going to get that. If you work with enough guys or enough girls, you're going to find people who just don't really want to do the recovery program. They're fine with the fellowship. They're fine with the camaraderie. Thank you. They really don't want to change. And you'll find that. But for the most part, most of the people who I was working with went through the steps. And this is no exaggeration. Every single one of those guys, and we're talking like the early 90s, the mid 90s, the late 90s, all the way till today. The people who went through the steps and actually did the steps, actually made a moral inventory, actually went out and made a direct amends. The people who did that and who learned the prayer and meditation disciplines and started to work with other alcoholics. Every single one of those guys is still around. Every one of them is a card-carrying AA member in good standing. Every one of them. They're all working with other alcoholics and their quality of life is out the roof. Every single one of them. Every single one of the guys that bought or saw that this step work is an overreaction to a problem that they really have under control. You know, this is a little bit too crazy. There's amends and there's inventory. And I'm getting a new sponsor. Every single one of those guys is gone. Every one of them. And, you know, this is a lesson that I just have to see as an important one for me. What I believe today is we lose so many people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Any of the elders, any of the long-timers in here, you know, you ask them, how many people have they seen come through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous every single year? You know, you'll get 30, 40 people a year celebrating 90 days, but you'll get one or two people celebrating over 20 years. We lose so many people. What I believe is that to be able to stay in Alcoholics Anonymous, you have to do enough work. You have to do enough work with Alcoholics Anonymous, with the steps, the service, the meetings, to be able to get enough power back from Alcoholics Anonymous to be able to stay. And if you do enough of the things in the circle and the triangle, you're assured a seat in here. And you're assured permanent sobriety. And you're assured recovery, a place called recovered. On the first page of our book, it says we are 100 men and women who seemingly recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body. You know, to become recovered is possible. And how that looks is, that looks like your spiritual condition is healthy. You're not suffering from that anxiety. You're not suffering from that depression. You're not suffering from that guilt and that shame and that remorse and the resentments. That stuff is not in control of your emotional state anymore. You know, you're happy, joyous, and free. You understand what serenity is. And you can be of maximum service to God, your fellow man, and your family, and anybody else that's in front of you. Alcoholics Anonymous is the best deal that we'll ever get in our lives. For the small amount of effort that we have to put into this, we're not only assured survival from a progressively fatal illness, but we're also assured a really high quality of life. The ability to be what we want to be and be able to show up and be able to be a positive influence in the lives of others. It's the best deal out there. There's very few other progressively fatal illnesses with any kind of a recovery deal like this. And yet we sometimes look that deal in the eye and walk away from it. It's really, really tragic. Anyway, you know, there's probably people in this room tonight that love Alcoholics Anonymous as much as I do. I'm sure that there's no one that loves it more than I do. If you're new, if you're just coming back, if you've never been through the steps, there's two things you need to know. One of them is you're in way more trouble than you think you are. Whatever trouble you think you are minimizing like a sumbitch, okay? The other truth is you're not giving Alcoholics Anonymous enough credit for a large enough solution for your life, because the solution for all of the problems in your life is in here. I want to thank this group for having me. It's just been a pleasure. You've got some great stuff going on here. Thanks a lot.